supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're likely familiar with prepaid cell phone and debit cards allowing you to pay your bills up front. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Now, PICO wants to let you do the same thing with your energy bill. Though, as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, the company's proposal is getting some pushback from consumer advocates.
Here's what PICO's proposing. Instead of getting a monthly bill for the electricity or natural gas they've used, consumers would pay for their utilities up front. They would spend down the balance as they use energy and pay for more when the account gets low. The company's asking state regulators for permission to pilot this idea with 1,000 customers. PICO spokesman Greg Smore says the goal is to help them use less energy.
This closely ties your awareness about, you know, how much energy you're using and how much money that does cost you. So it also begins to kind of push people towards the ideas of, you know, using energy more wisely. It's good for folks with different budgets or different financial situations where it might be easier to break off smaller chunks of their energy bill over time versus paying one full bill after the energy has been consumed.
But consumer advocates aren't happy. They say the proposal is a way for utilities to get around a state law that bans them from shutting off power during winter months for people living at 250% of the federal poverty level. That's about $60,000 a year for a family of four. PICO says prepaying customers who don't pay would simply be choosing to disconnect their service. Patrick Cicero with the Pennsylvania Utility Law Project says that policy would create a second class of customers, the poor. He compares the situation to low-income people using prepaid cell phones.
If you run out of minutes in the middle of the month, that creates communication barriers. But if you run out of energy in the middle of the month, this is exponentially worse, right? You're subject to either extreme heat or extreme cold. You're subject to medical conditions, which may be aggravated.
PICO says the poorest customers would not be allowed to participate in the pilot. For others, the program would be voluntary, and they'd be able to go right back to getting monthly bills anytime. An administrative law judge for the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission will hear from both sides next month. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
For the past 10 years, Pennsylvania residents living in shale gas areas were concerned that fracking could pollute their water. Congress ordered the EPA to investigate, but its final report, 6 years in the making, says their conclusions are still limited by a lack of data. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
Let's go back to 2012. That's when a lot of focus and attention was on Dimock, a small rural town in northeast Pennsylvania. The area's water contamination was garnering international headlines, and Hollywood stars were dropping by. When I visited Victoria Schweitzer at her home then, she told me how a few years earlier, a man from the gas company had shown up, lease in hand.
It was a beautiful fall day. I was sitting on the steps of the trailer, and this man appeared, and friendly, twinkle in his eye, and said, "Beautiful day, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And I like to say that's the last honest thing I ever heard from a gas man.
Schweitzer described to me back in 2012 how her well water turned black soon after gas operations began. Then it turned orange, then soapy.
And it was foamy and gray, and it smelled.
She finally stopped drinking it.
This is supposed to be our wine closet, but it ends up being our catch-all for our water. We keep our bottled water in here, and we need to go get some because we're getting low.
Schweitzer blamed the gas company for polluting her water with chemicals. But that was hard to prove because there was no baseline water testing done at her home before the drilling. When the EPA announced its sweeping national study, the agency said it would look at the fate of water during the entire gas drilling process, from the moment it gets withdrawn, to the chemical additives, to the injections into the wells, to the wastewater transport and disposal. Schweitzer hoped for answers. The EPA used Dimock as one of their case studies. Researchers visited her house, sat at her kitchen table, tested her water. They did this all over the country. This month, the EPA concluded fracking does sometimes pollute water. The agency found badly constructed wells, frack water spills, and poorly treated wastewater can contaminate drinking water. But the EPA still can't say if gas drilling is what turned Schweitzer's water all those different colors. And it still can't say how many people like Schweitzer there are.
Well, I wish the report had more data in it.
Rob Jackson is a fracking expert at Stanford University.
I wish they had done more work trying to understand how frequently, how often things happen, rather than just talking about what can, could, and has happened. That's important, but it's not enough. If the EPA can do it, who can?
Jackson says the gas and oil industry is regulated by the states, not the federal government. So each state has different reporting requirements, and that makes it hard to get at the big picture.
The identification of data gaps is actually an important contribution to the science and not a failure.
Tom Burke is the EPA's science advisor.
We are just beginning to understand fracking, and there are not really a lot of reports about what's going on during the fracking process. For instance, basic information about where are the wells, the location of wells.
The EPA wasn't able to get industry to cooperate with the study. Eric Melito from the American Petroleum Institute says problems with oil and gas drilling are exaggerated.
We're not going to stand here and say no incidents occur. What we're going to say is this is a technology that's been around a long time. It's been successfully deployed. The risks are low.
After the fracking report came out, I called up Victoria Schweitzer again.
Good morning.
Hey, Victoria. It's Susan Phillips from
NPR.
How
are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. You got me going down memory lane here. You know,
she's no longer allowed to talk about her water. Like a lot of people who sue gas companies, their settlements prevent them from ever discussing what happened. Another source of lost data. But Schweitzer can talk about the EPA study.
So the fracking report's finally come out. And what do you think about it?
Well, you know, I think it gives them continued reason not to do anything. Well, we don't have the evidence. We don't have the data. We don't have the cooperation of the gas companies. Who's in charge here?
Schweitzer still lives in her same house on 7 acres of woods in Dimmock. She says she's lost hope that people like her can turn to the EPA for help. If fracking starts up again near her home, Schweitzer says she may follow in the footsteps of her neighbors and move. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Philadelphia Land Bank has just released its 2016 strategic plan. Let's make sense of it with Anne Fadulin, director of the city's Office of Planning and Development. Anne, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We spoke last in the spring, and let's again note for listeners that the name itself is a bit of a misnomer. The intent is not to bank land, but to actually have people withdraw.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what we say. We want this to be more like an ATM machine, not a 401k.
And so what progress has been made since we last spoke?
So I think we've made a lot of progress. Our goal this year was to really move the land bank from setup and organization into operation. So the first couple years were spent verifying what the city owned and clearing title, getting deeds in line, all of those kinds of things to get the land bank operational. Now, in this year, we've seen our first transfers into the land bank of some publicly held property, and then we've also tested for the first time the land bank's powers of acquisition, and we've actually gone out and acquired some properties through a mechanism that utilizes the sheriff sale process. And then we've also seen our first RFPs come out for workforce housing from the land bank, and we've awarded two of those three, and the third should be awarded shortly.
So in getting a sense of the parameters of this endeavor, where are the strengths? Where are you going to prioritize developing?
We're really focused on uses. So we are highlighting the ability for affordable housing, for workforce housing, market rate housing, also community gardens and green spaces, side yards, business expansion. We have goals established for each of those areas because we'd really like to promote those uses. As far as areas of the city that we're focused on, predominantly the land that the city has in public inventory is not in very strong market areas, so there we're going to really be reaching out for things like side yards and community open space, whereas in some of our stronger market areas, we're trying to see if there's opportunity for our business expansion and market rate housing, but also we're really our focus there to determine whether there's opportunities for workforce and affordable housing so we can try to create equitable development and mixed income communities.
How do you distinguish between affordable and so-called workforce housing?
So in our case, when we're talking about affordable housing, we really want to get into those lower incomes, kind of what is traditionally seen as where a low-income housing tax credit deal would fall in those income levels. Workforce housing, those folks may have the income and credit available to allow them to get into an ownership situation and be able to even, if we price the unit right, almost get it right off the market. But what we offer is the land for a dollar. So that allows the private developer to then offer it at a lesser price that's affordable to that 80 to 120% of median income range.
So with the conveyance of owners program getting underway last year, who's mostly taking advantage of it? Individuals? Business interests?
I would say the most activity we've had is around the workforce housing aspect. That's been a priority of City Council. They've been mostly going to private developers, and then also side yard agreements, which is basically community residents in an area that have been taking care of maybe the lot next to their house for a number of years, and we're now in the process of being able to actually convey that property to them. I would say those right now are probably the two most active uses, but we're gearing up to really reach out to the other folks. You know, again, more affordability in the housing realm, more business expansion, and hopefully more active open space planning as well.
Obviously, all the intent of the land bank and indeed the City Office of Planning and Development is dependent in large measure on many variables: tax base, population, the economy. How do you assess those variables going into 2017?
Well, you know, we do our best to be fortune tellers to some extent. We try to base it on data collection. We've looked at many different types of data, and we really try to assess where we see the markets happening, where we have land availability, and then what's going on in our community. You know, we do see our land values going up. We do see us as being an attractive city for development, but we realize that we have some challenges, that we still have a very high poverty rate, that we have a lot of affordable housing that is starting to kind of churn off, if you will. Either it's coming out of its compliance period if it got subsidy, or we're seeing what we call naturally occurring affordable housing being lost to more higher market. So we really kind of have to keep our eye on several different balls. And I think for the first time we're seeing the fact that we have publicly held land and we have this land bank as an asset and a tool in order to create more mixed income and equitable development neighborhoods, as opposed to seeing this vacant land as a blighting influence and something that just has to be dealt with. We're now looking at it as a tool and an asset, and how can we use it to the betterment of Philadelphia.
And thanks for joining us again to shed light on NewsWorks tonight.
Sure. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Anne Fedulin, Director of the City's Office of Planning and Development. It takes a lot more than designated lanes to cultivate a thriving bicycle culture in a city. Cyclists rely on repair shops to keep their chains and gears meshing smoothly. Philadelphia's Via Bicycle, just off South Street, has become an institution in the neighborhood, but now it's packing up and making a move, as WHYY's Paige Flager reports.
Via Bicycle is kind of a three-in-one shop. They fix and sell used bikes, but all of the vintage cycling paraphernalia and shelves of bike parts make it part museum and part library, too. Emerging from the crowd of spokes and pedals is owner Curtis Anthony. He has an old-timey handlebar mustache that's peppered with gray hairs. He wears a small beanie on top of his head like Steve Zissou from Wes Anderson's film The Life Aquatic.
Curtis at Via Bicycle. We've been here for a billion years. What is it, 1982 we started? This is our third location, and alas, we're moving.
By a billion years, he means 20, on 9th Street, south of South. Curtis hits the counter nervously with a bike flag as he talks. He tears up. This isn't just a bike store for him. It's also been his home for the last two decades.
And the neighbors are really disappointed.
How about you? Are you disappointed?
Yes, big time. I have, my kid is 11, and he headed out with me the other night that the rug is being yanked out from under him. He's been here forever, and moving is a big deal.
We walk past rows of bicycles into the shop where bike mechanics are making repairs and listening to heavy metal. Curtis slides open the fire doors to reveal even more bicycles.
We call this the bomb shelter. It's a room full of stored bikes.
We climb the stairs, which are lined with old cycling posters. The second floor holds the vintage bike collection, which keeps the business afloat in the wintertime when far fewer people walk through the door. Curtis's cat winds through his legs as he tries to navigate around piles of parts.
What's your cat's name?
Wilbur.
Wilbur. You had to think about it for a sec.
I was thinking which one he was because every cat I've ever had has been named Wilbur, and I think this is the fourth one. So he's Wilbur 4. I switched the tags. It's like a car.
The third floor has more storage, antiques, and odds and ends.
As I go around the building, I'm looking for things that I might send out to auction. And we, like I say, I'm stressing, we have to reduce our volume.
By how much, do you think?
About half.
That's daunting.
That is daunting. Yeah, I don't look worried, but I'm not sleeping well.
And finally, on the fourth floor, Curtis shows me his apartment. He points out paintings on the wall of his son riding his bicycle. A four-poster bed is in the middle of the room next to an ornate old couch that he's never sat on. His back deck looks out over Philadelphia's skyline. The view alone is enough to see why he got priced out of this massive property. His building and the one next to it just sold for roughly $2.2 million.
It's a tough business to be in, there's no doubt.
That's Simon Firth, one of the owners of another Philadelphia bicycle shop, Firth & Wilson Transport Cycles.
Real estate in Philadelphia is going through the roof. It's happening all over. I see it in Berlin, bike shops getting closed down, in Portland, in San Francisco, in Seattle. People are getting priced out. But so are the people on the bikes, too. So you move to the next neighborhood.
And that's exactly what Curtis is doing, moving to another neighborhood a bit south of where he is now, at Broad and Bainbridge. Lynn Denton has been in her row home across the street from Via Bicycle for nearly 40 years.
You know, it was artists and craftspeople and people like Curtis also who came in and made this a very desirable place to live. We'll miss him. We'll definitely miss him a lot on this block.
Not too far away from Via Bicycle lives Francisco Reyes. He and his daughter plan to travel the few extra blocks to see Curtis at his new shop.
My daughter is actually 5 years old, and she calls him Mr. Mustache. She loves Mr. Mustache. I'm like, I'm going to the bike store. She's like, say hi to Mr. Mustache for me, you know. So, yeah, she's going to be really sad to hear that he's leaving. I feel like Curtis doesn't necessarily treat me like a customer. He treats me like a friend.
Curtis has to have the massive store packed up by the end of January. His new shop is about a third of the size as the one he has now, but he's trying to stay optimistic.
Here we're at 606 South 9th Street, and we have so much space that we don't well utilize. And so we're looking forward to the move, giving us an opportunity to reorganize, because now we have so much inventory, it's kind of in our way of making money.
Curtis doesn't have a place to live yet, but seeing old and new faces at the new location will hopefully make it feel more like home. For WHYY, I'm Paige Flager.
We're just a few days out from ringing in the new year, and a lot of parents with small children face a dilemma. The kids want to stay up for the big moment, but it's way past their bedtime. Well, Netflix is offering a way for parents to trick their kids into getting into bed on time while still allowing them to do the countdown. They're offering on-demand countdown clocks. Now you can get the kids to bed at 8, and they'll think they've made it all the way to 2017. Parents can pick from 10 videos marked countdown at any time on the 31st, and they can use the countdowns as many times as they like, whenever they like. Now for those that feel guilty, remember, 30 time zones will reach 2017 before Philadelphia, so your kids are celebrating the new year, just maybe not here. Time to pull the plug on tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. The state of Pennsylvania is scheduled to enact large-scale layoffs in its unemployment compensation offices, and tomorrow evening, we'll look at what that'll mean for job seekers and those collecting benefits in the state. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.